Well, as we know, nothing ever goes in a straight line, and the Jewish people, as they left Egypt, are no exception to that rule. The pasuk at the beginning of the parasha, "Vayhi b'shalach paro es ha'am," so as the paro dispatched the people, "V'lo nacham elokim derech eretz plishtim," Hashem did not guide them by way of the plishtim, ki korovu, although it was near, or perhaps because it was near. Kiyamar Elokim, for Hashem said, Pen yinachem ha'am be'osa milchama, perhaps or lest they will have regrets, second thoughts, when they see war, v'shavu Mitzrayim. They'll go back to Mitzrayim. What is the meaning behind this concern? I think certainly the common understanding is that the Jewish people may be afraid. They're met with war, they may backtrack to Mitzrayim. Although one could perhaps observe, if they're met with war, they may not have the opportunity to go back to Mitzrayim. Once you're in a war, the people that are warring with you don't always give you the opportunity to reverse your trail and go back to Mitzrayim. It's also interesting that the expression uses Pen yinachem ha'am. Perhaps they will have a change of heart. We normally, in our own words, would describe the concern that perhaps they'll be afraid. I think that's how we normally express it, but the pasuk doesn't say perhaps they'll be afraid. It says perhaps they will regret. Fear and regret are not exactly the same thing. Additionally, the pasuk refers to bir'osam milchama, when they see war. Again, something of a euphemistic way of referring to being in a war. If you're in war, you're not just seeing war, you're in it. Why is the concern phrased as them seeing war? And moreover, Mefarshim raised the question, which war? Who exactly is warring with them? They'll have their own wars and that they'll need to deal with at the time. And for these reasons, the Ksav Sofer, the son of the Chasam Sofer, Rebbe from Shmuel Ben Yamin Schreiber, took over from his father in Pressburg. And very often he has these very interesting insights. And he suggests that perhaps the worry was not that they will be afraid when confronted with war, but perhaps something else. It's very interesting that as B'nai Yisrael left Mitzrayim, we never find any form of armed struggle or confrontation between them and the Egyptians. They were oppressed for so many years, and as soon as the pressure was relieved and the time came to go, they went. But there were never any recriminations or any form of trying to perhaps take vengeance on their oppressors of so many years. The reason why, says the Ksav Sofer very simply, is that having been slaves for all of those decades, they were not schooled in the art of war. Tell them now is the time to exact vengeance, I mean, they wouldn't know how. So they leave. What's the worry? Perhaps they'll learn how. How would they learn? By seeing war. The concern here is not that they themselves will be in a war. Who's going to wage war with them? Amalek are not yet on the horizon. But perhaps now that they're free, they may see other nations warring. Bir'osam milchama. And when they do, perhaps they'll have one regret. Why didn't we do this to Mitzrayim before we left? And they may even wish to go back and say, we have unfinished business with Mitzrayim. We didn't know how at the time. We've learned a thing or two. We've been vigilant and we've seen how it's done. Perhaps they'll go back. There's no going back, not even for that. It's a very interesting approach to this well-known pasuk and the beginning of Beshalach. But as we move further in pasuk Yutes, we find a very interesting, almost parenthetical comment. Pasuk Yutes, Vayikach Moshe es atzmos Yosef imo. Moshe took Yosef's bones with him. Ki hashbeya hishbeya esbnei Yisrael lemor, for he had adjured the Jewish people with an oath, made them take an oath, and hashbeya hishbeya, that they should take an oath and make others take an oath throughout the generations, lemor, saying, Hakod yufkod elokim eschem, Hashem will indeed take account of you, and when he does, v'halisem es atzmozai mizeh itchem, take me up with you. So says Yosef, and Moshe does so. Now what's very interesting is, and I haven't seen many Mefarshim who raise this question, but this pasuk, which is an important, shall we say, part of what happened when we left Mitzrayim, it seems to be out of place. For the simple reason that, as we will see the details in just a few moments, you cannot take Yosef's bones up from Mitzrayim after you've left. I mean, this is something that happens when you leave. The Jewish people didn't leave Mitzrayim in Parshas Beshalach. They left in Parshas Bo, which means in Shmos Perek Yud Beis, which has a lengthy description of the events that accompanied the Bnei Yisrael leaving Mitzrayim, that would be the place to say, and when they left, Vayikach Moshe, Esat Moshe, Yosef Imo. But they've already gone, and it's been a few days, and this is the point where the Torah chooses to tell us that when they left, Moshe took Yosef's bones. It seems to be almost like a delayed entry for this piece of information. Ma inyan atzmos Yosef etzel parshas b'shalach. What is this point of taking Yosef's bones? What does that have to do with getting closer to the chase already? Post Exodus. And how does Moshe come to take Yosef's bones? The Gemara describes this at length in detail in Maseches Sota on Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. And there, the Gemara states that when the time came, and Moshe is ever mindful of this oath that everyone has to take Yosef, and he decides that he will do it. And the Gemara states that Moshe went to Serach Bas Osher, who is just there throughout everything. And she knows everything. Things that no one knows, Serach knows. And here's a good example, because she just was there. So she just remembers. For everyone else, it's three or four generations. Serach is three or four generations. And Moshe says to her, the time has come for Bnei Yisrael to leave. Yosef told us to take him. Where is he? And Serach told him where he was. And the Gemara raises the question, how does Moshe know? And he went to Serach, she told him. What's fascinating is that apparently without Serach telling Moshe where Yosef is, he wouldn't know. And no one else knew, which is fascinating because Yosef must have been one of the most famous people in all of Mitzrayim. I mean, he saved the country, he's certainly a known entity, and no one knows where he's buried. It's the most unusual situation. Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, that's true. No one knew where he was buried. Because as much as at the time, Yosef was much loved, much revered, but the new regime, who did not know Yosef, and didn't recognize him, and didn't recognize his contribution, he was basically made a posthumous persona non grata, whereby part of stamping out any recognition of Yosef is that no mention was made, no one was allowed to visit his grave, and with the passage of time, it just got lost, the knowledge. It's an amazing thing how a person can just be erased from history if it doesn't suit the current regime. And that's something which would repeat itself much closer to our times, and also much closer to where Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky grew up. And therefore, no one knows, except for Serach, who didn't forget. What's also fascinating, and this is a comment which is made by Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, the famous Ben Ish Chai, and he asks an almost a deconstructive question. Moshe goes to get Yosef, and the Gemara says, how does Moshe know where Yosef is? says Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad in his Chidushei Agodas Ben Yehoyada, Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest prophet of all time. That means he is the last person you would ever look at and ask, well, how did he know that? He's Moshe. If anyone knows anything, Moshe knows everything. And it's very curious that the Gemara says, he goes for Yosef, and the question, well, how does he know where Yosef is? Maybe because he's Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu just knows things. And the Ben Yehoyada says, it's true, Moshe is the greatest of the Nevi'im, and a Navi can always access information from higher realms and know things that in a ways that other people couldn't know. That's true. However, says Ben Yehoyada, Moshe is currently involved in a mitzvah. The mitzvah of making good on the vow that Yosef had people take, that they would take him out. Says Ben Yehoyada, when you're doing mitzvahs, you're on your own. It's up to your own resources. Because if you get all of this, extracurricular assistance, and you don't know where he is, but you can just ask your Nevuah, and then your Nevuah will tell you, and maybe it's difficult to get there, but then you have other things that will work for you. And where's the mitzvah? What is the point of a mitzvah if not doing it yourself? And therefore, even Moshe Rabbeinu, when he comes to fulfill the mitzvah, if he wants to know where Yosef is, he's got to make a trek, find someone who knows, and find out the good old-fashioned way. It's very interesting. This is reminiscent of a well-known comment that the Mefarshim make with regards to an earlier situation such as this, whereby Eliezer, when he comes to the well to find someone for Yitzchak, so Rivka comes out and he goes to Rivka. So why does he go to Rivka? Well, there's many reasons. The Pasuk itself says she was very beautiful. But Rashi quotes from the Medrash that he saw something in Rivka that made him think, I should start here. Namely, when she went down to the well, the water came up to greet her. So, all things being equal, that's a good asset. Eliezer says, I'll try her first. And he does. And he asks her for some water. And the pasuk proceeds to say that she took a jug, and she drew the water, poured it out, and went back, and drew the water, and poured it out. And the question is, whatever happened to her skill of having the water rise up to meet her? I mean, that's what attracted his attention in the first place. And she could do with that just about now because she's drawing water for 10 camels. But the Mefarshim say the point is exactly the same. When Rivka comes out, she's coming out for herself, shall we say, for her family. If you have nisim, good for you. But nisim have no role within mitzvahs, because if you perform your mitzvah by a miracle, so then where's the mitzvah? And therefore, for her own purposes, the water can come up to her. But when she does a favor, when she does a kindness for someone else, so then she goes down and draws out the water the good old-fashioned way. And that really resonates with what the Ben Yehoyada says about Moshe. Mitzvahs, there's no entry for miracles within mitzvahs, because that's not what mitzvahs are all about. So, as the Gemara describes, Moshe goes to Yosef and essentially issues an ultimatum to him. And for this sort of thing, you really do have to be Moshe Rabbeinu, because he says, Yosef, the Bnei Yisrael are leaving. You said to take you with, I've come for you. Yosef is in a metal coffin at the bottom of the Nile. Moshe says, we're leaving now. If you want to come with us, so come with. And if not, don't say I didn't come to get you. And at that point, so then Yosef's coffin floats up, and then Moshe takes it. So there was this element of where it's not possible in any other way. So then I guess for that you really do have to be Moshe Rabbeinu. But in any case, Yosef is with Moshe, and that is that pasuk which Mitzvah Hashem we may yet need to come back to. This rather a parenthetical part of the episode. But in the meanwhile, Paro has had a change of heart. He sets out in pursuit of Bnei Yisrael. And let's take a look in Perek Yud Dalet, Pasuk Yud. Uparo Hikriv Perek Yud Dalet Pasuk Yud. Paro draws near. Vayis'u v'nei Yisrael esei nehem. The Jewish people, they raise up their eyes. which is not always a good idea if you're in the Chumash. You never know what will happen when you raise up your eyes. V'inei Mitzrayim nosei achareihem. Mitzrayim are there, pursuing them. V'yiru'ma'o, they became very afraid. V'yitz'aku b'nei Yisrael el Hashem. They cried out to Hashem. Rashi has a wonderful comment here. V'yitz'aku, they cried out, says Rashi, tofsu umanus avosa. They took up the craft, the umnus, the trade of their forefathers, of their forebearers. You see, the avos, their davening at these significant times. When it comes to Avram, it says, elamakom asha omacham, that's its expression of prayer. With regards to Yitzchak, lasuach basadeh, that's also an expression of tefillah. With Yaakov, vayifka bamakom, that's shachris mincha and mairiv, from the three avos. That's the trade of the avos. And these significant times, they're davening, and here's the Jewish people, they're in trouble, and they cry out to Hashem, and that's picking up on the trade of their fathers. Why does Rashi say this? Says Maskil David, very simply. Look at Pasuk Yud again, which states, Paro hikriv, Paro draws near, Vayis'u b'nei Yisrael eseinehem, they raise up their eyes, and they are afraid. Who is afraid? Well, B'nai Yisrael. How do we know? Pasuk didn't say. They're the only plural noun in the Pasuk, and they've been mentioned at the beginning of the Pasuk. B'nai Yisrael lift up their eyes. They are afraid. How does the Pasuk conclude? Vayitzaku B'nai Yisrael el Hashem. And B'nai Yisrael cried out to Hashem. It's still the same B'nai Yisrael, and we've been working with pronouns, because we said Vayiru, and we understand that it's them. So say Vayitzaku, and we'll understand that it's them. Why does the Pasuk reiterate that it's B'nai Yisrael? The point is, says Maskil David, that's what Rashi's picking up on, because we know who they are, but the Pasuk repeats B'nai Yisrael as if to say they cried out as B'nai Yisrael. It's emphasizing their connection with their forefathers. So here's the Jewish people in prayer. Well, let's hear the Jewish people in prayer. Next, or let's hear the Jewish people cry out. Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayomru el Moshe. They said to Moshe, Hamiblien kevarim b'mitzrayim, what, not enough graves in Egypt? Lekachtanu lamus b'midbar, you took us to die here. Mazos asi salonu, what do you do? What have you done to us? Lo tzionu b'mitzrayim, to take us out. Halozeh davar shedibarnu lecha b'mitzrayim neymar. We told you in Egypt. Chadal mimene, leave us alone. V'navdas mitzrayim, we'll serve mitzrayim. Ki tov lana avodas mitzrayim, mimuseinu b'midbar. Better to serve them than to die here. And Maharal, in the Gurari, asks a simple question. You call that the trade of their fathers? I mean, that's awful. Better we hadn't heard what they said. In the original Pasuk, by Yitzhakos B'nai Yisrael, one can only imagine what they're saying. It's all very exalted. Until you hear what they said, that doesn't sound very exalted at all. So how are we to reconcile the glowing description that we have? Umnus Avosam, you see, just like the fathers. Really? That's not just like the fathers. I don't think the fathers would be very proud of what their children are saying right now. So is it the trade of the fathers or not? Says Maharal a wonderful thing in the Gur Aryeh. The Pasuk never says that this is their trade. It says it's their father's trade. What does that mean? It means sometimes you have a trade that's in the family. And what does it mean for, shall we say, the younger generation or the youngsters or the children? So they have a certain affinity for it. They have a certain aptitude for it. They have a certain, they're very comfortable. It doesn't mean they're proficient. If you have a musical family, so they hear music the whole time. So a young child of 3 or 4, so he sees a violin, he's for sure going to pick it up. Because his parents do, and his older brothers do, and his older sisters do, so he picks it up. Now, when he picks it up, this young child of 3 or 4, he can make a noise that will have... They'll call the police. No one knows what's happening. But he's merrily sawing away. What is that? It's the combination of the fact that he has no inhibitions, because it comes very naturally for him to pick it up, but he has no talent. He hasn't developed anything. And that's how it starts. It starts with noise, with an awful racket. And that's what the Jewish people sound like at this stage. They're not yet schooled. They haven't yet really risen to the occasion. They haven't yet developed themselves in tefillah. But they know they've got to say something. Why? Because they're Jewish. Because they're from Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You always say something. But what do you say? Well, it depends who you are. If you've developed in the trade of prayer, you know how to pray. And if not, so then you start complaining. But you've got to say something. And that's exactly what happens here, says Baal. Savosam. It will be a while yet until it became their trade as well. In the meanwhile, this is what it sounds like. So says Gur Ari. But there is another approach, and it really is an overarching theme throughout all of the early parshas of Shemos. And that is, as Mefarshim explained, and this is discussed by Reb David Tevel, one of the great Talmidim of Reb Chaim of Volozhin, in his drushes, Beis David, we have a certain assumption that we make. We enter with a presumption. And that is that if you see how the Jewish people talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you see how the Jewish people talk to Moshe Rabbeinu, you can assume that they'll say the same thing to both. Not always, and certainly not yet. And what does that mean? It brings us back to a concern that Moshe himself voices in the burning bush, where he talks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a week. And at a certain point, he says, this is in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Aleph, Vayan Moshe Vayomer, Vehein lo yaminu li, they won't believe me. They won't believe that you sent me. That's what he says. Now, the question is, was Moshe right to voice that concern? Here we have to speak very carefully, because we're speaking about Moshe Rabbeinu. In the event, Moshe was punished for saying that, as we will see. But on the other hand, when he says they won't believe me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives him signs. That's the point where he gives him the signs with the staff and with his hand becomes leprous and with the water to blood. If Hashem gives him signs, that means Hashem is concurring with him. It is a concern. So if it's a concern, why is Moshe criticized for voicing the concern, which apparently is valid? So here the Mefarshim say, voicing a concern is one thing, but not every concern needs to be voiced as a definite. The problematic term in Moshe's words is not they won't believe me, but the word vehein. Vehein lo yaminu li. Not vehein with a mem. It doesn't mean they won't. Vehein doesn't mean them. Vehein means indeed. Means Moshe is convinced they won't believe him. And on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, voicing a concern is one thing. Being convinced that this will happen, that's a separate question altogether. And thus we find that it's actually the word hein that haunts Moshe, so to speak, years later. Because in Parshas Vayelech, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, at the very end of the 40 years in the Midbar, Vayomar Shem Moshe, hein karvu yamecha lamus. Indeed, your days have come near to die. And the Medrash says Moshe was upset, because to be told that news is one thing, but why is he told with the word hein? And he asks Hashem, why are you saying hein to me? I've used the word hein to praise you. Parshas Ekev, hein l'Hashem Elokeinu, Shemayim u'Shemei Shemayim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, yeah, but your first use of the word hein was wrong. Because you said vehein la yaminu li. That's the midah keneged midah. Again, on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. But the concern is a concern. But why is it even a concern? Aren't the Jewish people, aren't they waiting for Geula? And therefore when someone comes and says, you know, Geula is nigh, why is it so likely that they won't believe him? But the answer is, and again, we look in hindsight, but if we put ourselves in the minds of the Jewish people, they do believe in Geula, and they are waiting for Geula, but not for themselves. They're waiting for Geula for their great-great-grandchildren. And what that means is, everyone is very much aware of the prophecy that was given to Avram, the Bris Ben HaBesarim, Kigeria Zarach Beretz Lelehem, Vavodim Inu Osam, Arba Meir Shana, 400 years. Wherever that land is, and whatever is going to happen there, the simple understanding is that they will be for 400 years in the same location. Now, as we know, that didn't happen. And there are many explanations as to why it didn't happen. And even after you explain it once they came out, but you have to appreciate, when the Jewish people heard this prophecy that they're going to be there for 400 years, they didn't hear it, not with Rashi's Perish, and not with the Medrash, and not with any other commentators. That means they just heard the words, 400 years, and to them, that sounds like 400 years. Which means, by their reckoning, they are 209 years into a 400-year term. Do they believe in Geula? Yes. For them, no. And therefore, the massive reorientation that needs to take place within the Jewish people is to get them to appreciate that the Geula is going to happen to them. Moshe says they will not believe me. It's just not in their consciousness for now. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives Moshe another sign, a linguistic sign. In other words, there's the act that he's to do, but there's also something else. And they really are the watchwords for redemption from Mitzrayim. Namely, as is mentioned in Perigimel Pasuk Tet Zayin, Pako Tokadati, Hashem says, go and tell Bnei Yisrael, Pakod Pakadati, I have indeed taken account of you and that which was done to you in Mitzrayim. And then Hashem says, and they will listen to you. And Rashi explains, and it's from the Medrash, when you say Pakod Pakadati, they'll listen to you. Why? Because they know. They know that these are the words with which they will be redeemed, because that's the tradition that's been handed down to them. Yosef said to them, Pakod Yivkod Elokim Eschem. First Yaakov said it, then Yosef said it. Now, once again, the question is, who knows? Who knows these words, that these are the words of redemption? If everyone knows them, then it doesn't really prove anything about Moshe, because it's well known that the Geula will start with Pakod Pakadati. That may well be. That's not the same as saying that whoever says Pakod Pakadati is the Goel. I mean, what else can he say? Everyone knows that that's how it starts, Pakod Pakadati. In fact, the Pirkei Rabbi states that not everyone knew about this special phrase. It was actually a closely guarded secret. And moreover, by the time Moshe came, there was only one person who knew about Pakod Pakadati. And that person is Serach Bas Osher, who is back again. Serach Bas Osher is the advisor for all matters of redemptive. It seems she knows Pakod Pakadati, she knows where Yosef is. She is a very, very unique individual, and she has very important information. And the Pirkei Rabbi says the elders they conferred with Sarah when Moshe came. They said they didn't know what to make of it. So they came to Sarah, right, who's there, who knows more than anyone else. They told her what happened, and Sarah said, "Tell me exactly what he said." As soon as they quoted Pakod Pakadati, Sarah said, "That's him." Now the question is, What's the meaning of Pakod Pakadati? The word Pakod means to take account of, but it's doubled over. And whenever we see phrases that are doubled over in the Chumash and we wish to study the Chumash carefully, we have to approach those phrases carefully, because the standard interpretation doesn't always, standard translation more correctly, doesn't always help us. These double expressions could be translated as surely or as indeed. I mean, these are words that are there just to compensate for the fact that there's two words here. But what does it actually mean? If you look at the words Pakod Pakadati grammatically, the difference between them is Pakadati is the past tense, I've taken account of you. And what does Pakod mean? Pakod is a similar root, but it's not in any tense. It's actually in a state which is called, a form that's called the absolute form. It's infinitive. It's absolute. It means taking into account, but it's not bound in any way. It's an absolute form. So, what's the meaning of Pakod Pakadati? Pakod Pakadati has an absolute form because those are the words that will herald the absolute redemption. In other words, if Pakod means Hashem will take into, has taken people into account and therefore is going to help them, but to what degree is he going to help them? As a temporary measure? Pakadati means I've taken in account of you and here we'll help you, but we're not out. But Pakod Pakadati means I have absolutely taken account of you. And what that means is that the reaction that comes from that, what follows on from there, is likewise absolute. I can paraphrase Lord Acton here, but it may help us. If accounting redeems, then absolute accounting redeems absolutely. That means that Pakod Pakadati means the entire exile is over. You are absolutely free. That's why these are the watchwords for Geula. Okay. Now it happens to be that the Pasuk states that when Moshe came and said all this to Bnei Israel, they believed him. Very nice. What exactly does the Pasuk say? Let's take a look. In Perek Dalet Pasuk Lamed. Or Perek Dalet Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Or if we start with Pasuk Lamed, Vayidaber Aaron Es Kol Advarim Asher Dibur Hashem Moshe. Aaron spoke all those things that Hashem had said to Moshe. Right? Aaron speaks on Moshe's behalf to the Jewish people already at this stage. Vayasa Osas Le'enei Ha'am, he performed those signs. And now Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Vayamein Ha'am, the people believed. You see, Moshe's fears apparently unfounded. The people believed. But what did they believe? Pasuk says, Vayamein Ha'am, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. And they listened, meaning they heard the message. Ki pakad Hashem es b'nei Yisrael, that Hashem had taken account of Yisrael, v'chi ra'ayas anyam, and he had seen their affliction. What do we see in this pasuk? Says David Tevel, you see the subtotal of what the Jewish people believed at that stage. The whole point of this phrase is that it is an absolute phrase. Pakod pakadati, because you have been absolutely accounted, meaning you are to be absolutely redeemed. And the Pasuk says Bnei Yisrael believed, but it doesn't say that they heard ki pakod pakad Hashem es Bnei Yisrael. It just says ki pakad Hashem es Bnei Yisrael, just the one term. And that is not an absolute term. Meaning, if we follow carefully at this early stage, there was no question for the Jewish people that Hashem had taken account of them and that their position would be alleviated somewhat, but not absolutely, not necessarily. That they still were not on board with because they couldn't get over the fact that they're meant to be here for 400 years, which means that if there's going to be some type of pekida, some type of redemption, it may only be temporary in nature. It may be a respite, but not a full. And that means that when Moshe comes, and it's known that Moshe is asking Paro for 3 days, and this is a fascinating insight here. And Moshe asks Paro for 3 days, and Paro's not interested in anything at that stage. But it's known that Moshe is asking for 3 days. Many of Bnei Yisrael, and perhaps most of Bnei Yisrael themselves, only thought that they were going out for 3 days. They expected to come back because the 400 years isn't over. We need a break. And 3 days after 210 years is a well-deserved break. But it's not over. And once we appreciate that it is very possible that the Jewish people were only on board with a temporary exodus, so to speak, but not a permanent one, we can then understand why they reacted the way they did when Moshe said, keep going, we're not going back to Egypt. And then they raise their eyes and they see the Egyptian army is behind them to come and to take them back. How do they react? Their reaction is twofold. Firstly, they daven to Hashem. Secondly, they complain to Moshe. And as far as the B'nai Yisrael are concerned, these two reactions are not in any way contradictory to each other. Because in their understanding, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plans and Moshe's plans are not identical for them. Hashem himself, 3 days. That's what they heard, and they're okay for 3 days. If we go and then we come back, so then we'll weather it, and then generations down the line we'll be out for good. But then Moshe tells them, and they only hear from Moshe, and Moshe says keep going, and at that point they're not sure, is this Moshe? Because we know 3 days. It's day 7 already. And look what's happened. The Egyptians, and they don't know whether what Moshe said to them has the backing from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why they have no problem, on the one hand, davening to Hashem to help them, and then voicing their complaints to Moshe. What are you doing? Why do you take us out? Meaning, why do you take us out and not bring us back? And indeed, it was not until Kriyas Yamsuf that the alignment in the minds of B'nai Yisrael of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wishes for them and those wishes as communicated by Moshe was complete. As if to say, when the sea splits in front of you, so then you know HaKadosh Baruch Hu is behind this. And that's why after Kriyas Yamsuf it says, finally, Vayaminu B'Hashem Uva Moshe Avdo. That full fusion of their understanding that what Moshe says from the altar is absolutely as HaKadosh Baruch Hu behind him, that was not clear to them until this stage. And that's what's behind the split reaction that they have. And perhaps one may say that this is why the Pasuk talks about Yosef's bones in Parshas Bishalach and not in Parshas Bo. Chronologically, when did Moshe take the bones? When we left Mitzrayim. But the Pasuk doesn't talk about it then. It talks about it in Bishalach because it is part of the setting up of the situation in Parshas Bishalach. You see, if you leave Mitzrayim, what determines whether you'll take Yosef's bones with you? The answer is, if you're just leaving for 3 days, it's not worth it. But if you're leaving for good, so then you take Yosef with you. And in fact, because Yosef himself, that we hear these words, and again, the Pasuk reiterates them, because Yosef said to them, Pakod yifkod elokim eschem, Hashem will absolutely take account of you, and then take me with you. And that's how Parshas Bishalach begins, because Moshe did. But it's emphasizing the fact that Moshe represents, this is the absolute redemption. Other people, not so sure. That's the tension in the beginning of Parshas Bishalach, which was only resolved for good, or at least fundamentally, with the miracles that Hashem performed for B'nai Yisrael. Now, when we come to Kriyas Yamsuf itself, so there's a fascinating comment of the Mishnah in Perkei Avos. In the fifth chapter, where it has many of the lists of tens and sevens and fours. So one of the lists of tens talks about Asara Nisim Nasu Lavoseinu Al Yamsuf. 10 miracles were performed for our forefathers, for B'nai Yisrael, at the Yamsuf. The Pasuk describes the miracle of the split, but the Mishnah tells us that there were actually 10 miracles. And the Mefarshim elaborate on these miracles. What were they? We know many of them. The sea actually split into 12. Right? Each Shevet has its own. That's a miracle within a miracle. That's why the Pasuk says, Legozer Yamsuf Ligzarim. The Pasuk in Tehillim. Legozer Yamsuf Ligzarim. Gezarim are strips. Now, the way we normally understand Kriyas Yamsuf, that you take the sea and you split it in half, there's no strips. There's two halves of a sea. There's no strips anywhere. But the sea itself was torn into strips because there was a partition of sea between each of the tribes. And the water was like glass. You could see through it, and each tribe could see each other. And there was, for their convenience, there was even water. Meaning drinking water. The sea water is not drinkable. But it was a wall, but then you could, I don't know what the correct expression is, I would say in any case, tap into the walls of the sea, and there was drinking water available for them, which is absolutely a matter of pure convenience. And so on and so forth. What is behind these miracles? I mean, the goal is to get the Jewish people to the other side, or to whatever side of the Yam Suf they ended up on. But the point is to get them through, and the Mitzrim should not make it through. And that's the goal. Why does it need to be multiplied into 10 miracles? HaKadosh Baruch Hu seemed to be making a point of adding on miracles, and I mentioned for exactly that reason, even miracles that are not necessary. For most of the time, if they need a drink, so they either have drinking water with them or they don't. But you need to get it from the walls of the Yam Suf. I mean, that's mamash. That is a luxury miracle. What is the role of these 10 miracles? Well, on a simple level, as is always the case with all the miracles, beginning with the Makos in Mitzrayim, they are in order to impress upon Bnei Yisrael HaKadosh Baruch Hu's control of the world. I mean, that's what happens when the sea splits, and all of these things, and the more minor, or more correctly, the more detailed the miracle becomes, the more it is impressed on the Jewish people the miraculous nature of what is happening to them. And that's important for their rehabilitation in terms of their connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Egyptians paid the price. They footed the bill for this re-education because they were the ones that had uneducated the Jewish people about these things. There is a fascinating comment of Reb Shlomo Kluger in his Perush on the Pirkei Avos for again, the Mishnah says, Asara Nisim Nasu La'avoseinu, which we translate, the common translation, 10 miracles were performed for our fathers. And rightly so. That's the translation. But Reb Shlomo Kluger says there's another meaning here. What was the role of these miracles? They were to teach us. They were to school us and to educate us and to instill within us awareness of Hashem's control of the world. When someone teaches you something, they become like your father. As Rashi says in Parshas Bamidbar, that's why Aaron's sons were called Moshe's sons. And that's why Shlomo HaMelech keeps on addressing whoever's reading Sefer Mishlei as my son. Shema Bini. How do you know you're descended from Shlomo HaMelech? He's your father because he's teaching you. When you teach a person, you become their father. So if you learn a lesson from someone, they're your father. What if you learn a lesson from an event? From an experience? From a miracle? Says Shlomo Kluger, so that miracle becomes your father. Asara Nisim Nasu La'avoseinu, 10 miracles became like our fathers. On the Yam Suf, we had 10 fathers for that time because we learned 10 new lessons from those miracles. Asara Nisim Nasul Avoseinu, 10 Nisim became like Avoseinu. That's quite a chiddush. But that was first and foremost, and we see that in Shiras Hayam, which is really our expression of exaltation there, we say Ze Keli, this is my God, Ze Keli Va'anvei. There was such an imminence of apprehension of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and all of that came through these miracles, to the point that we said Ze Keli Va'anveyu. It's fascinating to consider, and in fact it will need to be a discussion for a different time, how that encounter with Hashem, which is called Ze Keli, is such an important part of Kriyas Yam Suf. As if to say, if we would ask, when did the Jewish people encounter Hashem upon leaving Egypt? We would probably say when they came to Har Sinai, and then he spoke to them, the Aseres HaDibros. But we see that from a fundamental point of view, there is already a major encounter in Kriyas Yam Suf, and they talk about it, and they say Ze Keli Va'anveyu. A second point as to why all of these miracles perhaps relates to our discussion of a few moments ago, namely that Bnei Yisrael were until this moment conflicted somewhat in terms of whether they understood that what Moshe was doing was really at Hashem's behest and upon Hashem's instructions. Now, and how is that resolved? Hashem splits the sea for them, but maybe that's just to save them, because he's not going to let them. He's not going to let them drown just because Moshe's kind of led them wherever he's leading them. But the point is, by laying on all of these miracles, there is no shadow of a doubt that this is all what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. There's different ways that you rescue a person. If they're where you want them to be, they get the full treatment. If you get them out of a tricky situation, so then they travel economy. They don't have drinking water and all of those things. And therefore, it's specifically the luxury miracles that it emphasized to Bnei Yisrael, this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. We're exactly where He wants Him to be, where He wants us to be. And Moshe was acting on Hashem's instructions when He told us not to go back. And hence, by Aminu Bashem, over Moshe Avdo. But I believe there is perhaps a further understanding of the role of these miracles. It's interesting that we look at Kriyas Yamsuf and we timestamp the splitting of the Red Sea as the time of our Geula. Why do I say that? Because as we say in Maariv, Shira Chadasha, pardon me, Shachris, Shira Chadasha Shibchu Geulin Neshim Ha'asfas Hayam, right? When we gone through the Red Sea, so we were called Geulin. And some say, in fact, that Rabbeinu Bachya says, V'tzeisi V'itzalti took place in Egypt, but V'ga'alti, number three, is Kriyas Yamsuf. And then V'lakachti is Matan Torah. So the Ga'alti is actually connected to Kriyas Yamsuf. How? So I'd like to recall a discussion that we've had a while ago from one of the great Darshanim of the 1500s in Italy, the Bina Le'itim, Rabbi Azaria Feggio. And he actually looks at the four expressions of Geula. Again, we know them so well, Votesi, Vitalti, Ga'alti, V'lokachti. And he asks, like everyone else, why four? It's redemption, and that's one thing. Why is it said in four ways? But the truth is, says the Bina Le'itim, there are four expressions of Geula because there were four aspects of our oppression in Mitzrayim. And therefore we had to be redeemed in four different ways, or from four different things. Because when you think about it, and he goes through, and as he presents it, you can see oppression against the Jewish people, any people, but the Jewish people specifically, can take one of four forms. It can be economic, financial oppression, excessive taxation, whatever it may be, discrimination in that way. It can be physical torment, and worse. It can be spiritual. To desensitize the Jewish people to matters spiritual and lead them into bad habits. But there's a fourth thing. There's a fourth type of oppression, and from a certain point of view, it is worse than some of the others. And that is, it is the oppression against the honor of the Jewish people. For people to be considered as nothing, as worthless. That's even before they have to work, or anyone takes their money. But to be regarded as worthless and meaningless and redundant, or worse, that's its own type of assault. Many people would take an assault on their pride much worse than they would take an assault on their assets, and perhaps even on themselves. And that is why there are four expressions of Geula. Because the Jewish people needed to be redeemed from all of these four forms of oppression. Votseisi is they get their money back. Votseisi es chemitachas sivlos Mitzrayim. The word sivlos appears in the original oppression with reference to money. Vayasimu alav sarei misim. Tax. Not taskmasters. Taxmasters. Leman anoso besivlosam. That burden is that Jewish people, all of a sudden, they need to foot the bill for who knows what building projects. And no one else does. That is oppression. V'itzalti eschem. This number two, me'avodosam, from the work itself, which is physical oppression. Number four, v'lakachti, of course, is Matan Torah, where the Jewish people are spiritually rehabilitated. And what about number three? V'go'alti. What is that? So what's very interesting is, if you look at the psukim there, you'll note that v'ga'alti, expression number three, differs from numbers one, two, and four. How so? Because number one says, v'otzeisi eschem from mitachas sivlos Mitzrayim. Number two, v'itzalti eschem from me'avodasam. Number four, v'lakachti eschem, I will bring you towards v'lakachti eschem lila'am. There is a scalar here. There's a direction, either from something or towards something. Expression number three, if you look at the beginning of va'era, it doesn't talk about redeemed from or redeemed to. It says, v'ga'alti eschem b'zroa netuya u'v'shvatim gedolim, with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. So that's very unusual, because and of course we normally just highlight the four expressions themselves. But if you look at the phrases, what is the meaning of having number three different than the others? It doesn't say redempt from what or to anything. But it substitutes the how from the where or the to where. How? With the outstretched arm, with great judgments. Why does the emphasis in expression number three on the how? Because this is the redemption of the honor of the Jewish people. After decades of being told that they're worthless, and they don't even need to be told already by this stage, it's known. A Hebrew's life is nothing. But along comes someone who happens to think that a Hebrew's life is actually worth quite a bit. And how do you see that? Because what a production. What does he do for the next year? No one ever did that for anyone else. The how is important, because it is through the how that the Jewish people's honor is redeemed. Through those that persecuted them receive great judgments, and Zroanatuya, which is a complete abrogation of the laws of nature, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I think they're worth it. And therefore it's that. And that's why Yetzias Mitzrayim, the whole thing could have happened on a much lower key. Pyro could have been debilitated and kept at home, and the pressure not let off until they're safely on the other side of who knows where. But it didn't happen that way. It happened in such a bombastic way. And what does that do? Except restores the honor of the Jewish people. When the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, they felt like $1 million. As the pasuk says, "Bnei Yisrael yotzim biyad rama." Why are they in such high spirits? Because look what just happened to them. And Kriyas Yamsuf was a higher level of this. How so? Because the miracles in Egypt were primarily directed against their oppressors, which was more in the form of judgment. Their oppressors were visited with plagues, with the Ten Makos. Kriyas Yamsuf is not just another miracle. It's the first miracle where the focus is actually the Jewish people themselves. As if to say, the balance, the center of gravity of the miracle has shifted. Whereas for the last year, the ones that have received the miracle, because it's a miracle of retribution, are the Egyptians. And then, by relief, the Jewish people are spared. Here, it's reversed. The recipients of the miracle are the Jewish people. On the contrary, it's the Egyptians who get the backlash of the miracle, because it just stops when they're in the middle of the Yamsuf. And therefore, we see a higher level of HaKadosh Baruch Hu laying on a miracle directly and purely for the Jewish people. And moreover, the more quote-unquote gratuitous miracles there are, and again, we come back to the drinking water, I mean, it's the icing on the cake. And what is that? That's all about restoring the honor of the Jewish people. And perhaps now we can understand why Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar says that the Jewish people are v'ga'alti is kriyas yamsuf, and we say that in the tefillah shir chadash shibchu ge'ulim, because the state of the Jewish people by the time they came out of the yamsuf, if you thought they couldn't feel any better than they did when they left Mitzrayim, they can feel better when they come out of the yamsuf. They've just received 10 miracles, 9 of them which were strictly unnecessary, and what comes out of that? Az yashir, then the Jewish people have been redeemed. That's shir chadash shibchu ge'ulim. The issue of the pride of the Jewish people is one that continues to be a part of the Golos. And that's why, as part of our tefillahs, when we daven for the redemption of the Jewish people, we daven not only for the redemption in terms of temporal means, and even in terms of spiritual, but we daven that the pride of the Jewish people should be restored. It's taken a beating over the centuries and the millennia. The geula isn't finished until the Jewish people emerge exultant, as they did, and as the pasuk says will happen. Ki meitzes chameret Mitzrayim are enu niflaos, just like you left Mitzrayim. So you'll see those niflaos again, and the honor of the Jewish people will finally and fully be restored. Should happen b'meir b'yomi.